For we use the term resistance of the dried product layer, but the driving force is the difference in pressure between at the sublimation front and the vapor pressure of ice that's on the condenser. So P sub I is the sublimation interface. P sub C refers to vapor pressure of ice on the surface of the condenser. Again, and we'll talk more about the resistance of the dried product layer. And then this is just conservation of energy. It says that the rate of heat transfer is equal to the rate of mass transfer times the heat of sublimation of ice, which is just over 2,800 joules per gram. Okay, so this approach assumes that we have a constant shelf temperature during primary drying. Why is that? Well, in my world, you know, we're working for clients that are just comfortable with doing it that way. They're accustomed to having a constant shelf temperature during primary drying, and there's a tendency to resist, even though we know that if you really want to optimize a freeze-dry cycle, you're not going to have a constant shelf temperature and you're not going to have a constant chamber pressure during that process. But this is, again, this is a developing approach and we will get there ultimately. But for right now, we're using a constant shelf temperature during primary drying. Okay. It also assumes that we have a constant value of the resistance of the dried product layer. Let me go back a minute. Whoops. We know that the resistance of the dried product layer is not constant. It starts out at zero. And as the sublimation front recedes, it's going to increase. Its maximum, just the greatest. So we use the maximum value of R, which is the one that we calculate at the end of primary drying. Okay, I think that was it. And also, the other assumption is that in establishing the equipment capability curve for the laboratory or pilot dryer, we assume that we're going to fill the dryer up. That's just a conservative assumption because in production, in our world anyway, the freeze dryers are generally completely full. I mean, every shelf is completely occupied by vials. So we feel the need to follow suit for laboratory and pilot equipment, even though it's the exception when we do a batch when the pilot freeze dryer is completely full. So with those as assumptions, we kind of move on with this. So the first thing we want to do is measure the vial heat transfer coefficient. So we fill the intended vial. Let's say that we would like to get it in the right ballpark for what we anticipate might be the final cycle. Now, we're going to come back to TDLAS in a little bit when we talk about process monitoring. In this work, in the work we do, we always measure mass flow rate by tunable diode laser absorption spectroscopy. How many are familiar with that? Couple. Okay. We'll talk about it more later. Basically, it's a near IR based in-process method that gives you the instantaneous whole approach to constructing a design space. But you don't have to do that. Anybody familiar with the smart freeze dryer technology? Yeah. That you can use that as well. The smart freeze dryer is where you close the valve between the chamber and the condenser for a few seconds. You monitor the transient pressure response. You fit the experimental curve to a model, but basically by measuring that pressure rise, you can calculate the mass flow rate. We don't use it, but I understand that that works fine. Okay. But at any rate, you need some way to measure the sublimation rate. You could do it gravimetrically if you want, just by weighing before and after, but that it's quite a bit of work and it's kind of tedious. Okay. So you establish, you freeze the product, you establish a pressure set point, you let it equilibrate, and you measure the sublimation rate that corresponds to that pressure. Then you increase the pressure set point and get a new sublimation rate, and you keep that up until you've covered the selected pressure range. Now, when we do this, we typically would fill vials in the afternoon of one day, allow them to freeze overnight, and we can finish the experiment the next day. It may take less than a full day to do this, so it's not real time consuming. And then we calculate the vial heat transfer coefficient at each pressure, and it's pretty much kind of plug and shut. So we were talking about supercooling as a stochastic or a random process, which is how it's done in the industry now, and nucleation and crystal growth. And this might be representative of an in freeze drying, where you've got multiple temperature sensors, and you're going to get, this is only a few, but you have a big range of amounts of supercooling. Early on, you're going to get a minimum amount of supercooling, and the longer, of course, more heat, and effectively a faster freezing. And again, why we care about this is that we would like to have a minimum amount of supercooling, because when the supercooling is minimal, you get a slower effective freezing process. Because of that, you tend to get larger ice crystals. And when those ice crystals sublime, they leave behind larger pores in the partly dried layer that are going to offer less resistance to flow of water vapor. Okay, so minimum supercooling means slow effective freezing rate, relatively low resistance of the dry product layer, and relatively fast sublimation. The other end of that spectrum is where you've got a higher level of supercooling, smaller effective ice crystal size, smaller pores in the dried product layer, higher resistance, slower sublimation. Of course, you have to design a freeze-dry cycle around the slowest vials to freeze-dry. Now, superimposed on this, you have to keep in mind that all of these traces represent a thermocouple in a vial. And when you put a thermocouple or any temperature measuring device in the product, you tend to minimize the amount of supercooling, because it's basically a foreign body there that's going to tend to trigger ice nucleation. So this presents a skewed picture of how much supercooling can take place because of the influence of the thermocouple. Now, we can partly get around that by putting a thermocouple on the outside of the vial. That way, it's there, it can monitor temperature, but it doesn't interact directly with the liquid. Okay, since we fill our product into clean, sterilized vials and we sterile filter the formulation, there's relatively little foreign material to help nucleate the ice crystals, so we tend to get a lot of supercooling. And this is the why we care, and I think it's probably what I've just said. It's a misperception that controlling the ramp rate of the shelf during freezing controls the freezing rate. The supercooling effects are going to win, not the ramp rate of the shelves. One of the old hands in freeze drying, he just passed away. I think he died maybe a week or so after Mike Bacall died. But he goes back to the very early days of freeze drying, and he said shelf freezing and freeze drying is paradoxical. He said the paradox goes like this: slow is fast, and fast is slow. So it's maybe useful to talk about that in a little bit. The slow is fast part of that. What he's talking about is that suppose you tell yourself, okay, I want to freeze this product really slowly. So I'm going to put it on a shelf and I'm going to ramp the shelf temperature down at a tenth of a degree a minute or something like that, really slow ramp rate. What you do with that is that you promote a lot of supercooling, and you allow a lot of time for thermal equilibration throughout the volume of fill. So that once you get that first ice crystal to nucleate, it freezes very rapidly. Okay. So that's the slow is fast. Okay. You think you're freezing it slow, but you're not. The fast is slow. It says, okay, so I'm going to get my shelf temperature down to minus 45 degrees, and then I'm going to put my filled vials, directly on the shelf. That ought to freeze it really fast, right? Well, not so much. The idea there is that by putting that, let's say the solution's at or near room temperature, when you put the vial on that pre-cooled shelf, you'll get ice crystals forming in the bottom before the liquid at the top of the volume of fill has even had a chance to cool off very much. In effect, you're seeding that system with ice crystals, and it will supercool little, if any. So there's a good argument to be made for putting vials on shelves that are already pre-cooled. And it makes sense in light of the slow is fast, fast is slow paradox. But you also have operational things to consider. We don't do that because we use this automatic loading unloading system. And if you already have the shelves at minus 45 or minus 50 degrees, what you're going to get is frost buildup on the shelves. And the frost on the shelves will interfere with the loading mechanism. It'll cause the vials to sort of trip on that accumulation of ice, and it'll cause vials to fall over. And the automatic loading system just doesn't work with a lot of frost on the shelves. But at least it makes, in terms of physical chemistry, it makes a lot of sense. So, freezing behavior is largely determined by what happens to the freeze-concentrated solutes. So we've already done our supercooling, and we've our ice crystals. And this cartoon is just what the microstructure of that frozen material might look like, where these are the ice crystals, and everything in here is freeze concentrate. You know, freezing is, you have to keep in mind, a dehydration process. You know, we don't commonly think of it that way, but certainly it is. You think about how they make freeze-concentrated orange juice. The squeezed juice goes into this refrigerated drum where you're expanding refrigerant in a jacket on the drum, and the drum turns very slowly, and of course it freezes out ice crystals on the surface of the drum, and it rotates up to where some sort of a knife will then scrape the surface, and the ice crystals fall into a basket, and that cold surface is renewed, and it comes back around through the juice, and that process continues until you've got this thick goop that's freeze-concentrated orange juice. And that's desirable because you're saving the volatile components, and you're saving both the flavor and the nutritional value of the orange juice by doing this dehydration process at very low temperature. And it's the same thing here, except that we don't physically separate the ice crystals from the freeze concentrate. We sublime the ice crystals away. So we have to be concerned about the fate of this freeze concentrated material. And if we look at that, for simplicity's sake, we're saying that we start with an aqueous solution. I know that you've been within the demonstration lab here, you're doing some work with organic solvents and in-process mass spec and so forth, but that's a little more complicated system, and we won't get into that at this point, not in this course. We start with an aqueous solution, and we have the cooling and the supercooling. We can't ignore the fact that some solute might crystallize out before the ice does. We simply have to be aware of that during the development process. But we're going to get ice nucleation and growth. So we get freeze concentration. We get increased ionic strength. If we freeze a solution of sodium chloride, for example, let's say it's normal saline, 0.9% sodium chloride, very common IV infusion fluid. If you freeze that, before the sodium chloride crystallizes out, it goes from about 0.15 normal to about 4 normal. So there's about a 25 to 30-fold increase in salt concentration before the sodium chloride freezes out. And we have to be aware of the potential for that increased ionic strength to have some adverse impact, particularly if we're dealing with protein pharmaceuticals, where we have to worry about the potential for aggregation. But ultimately something's going to happen. Now, it might be that the solute, for simplicity's sake, let's just say that we're dealing with one component dissolved in our solution. And since I started to talk about sodium chloride, let's just continue with a sodium chloride example. And I think I can best show you with a snippet of video again. We're looking at a sodium chloride solution under a microscope. Ruben's going to have more to say about this later. But here's our sample. It's just a thin film. We're monitoring the temperature. Notice we've got a lot of supercooling going on. And the first thing that happens is ice crystals nucleate, and that spreads through that volume of the sample. We call this the morphology of ice dendritic, and you can see why. It kind of looks like what? I'm trying to think of the word to describe this morphology, but anyway, it looks like this, kind of a fishbone. And this system looks like it's frozen because you've got ice there. But where the action is in the interstitial space between these ice crystals, and see it turning dark, and that secondary crystallization front, or eutectic crystallization front, is moving from right to left across our field of view. The interstitial material is liquid here and solid here. And the temperature is, notice how low the temperature is. And it sort of picks up speed until it runs up against a crystallization front that nucleated somewhere else in the sample, and they're finally going to run into each other along about here, and it's only at this point that the system is completely frozen. It consists of pre-eutectic ice crystals and a eutectic mixture of sodium chloride and water. And we're going to show that this eutectic mixture melts at a pretty sharp temperature within about range of about a tenth of a degree right there. Okay, that is what we call eutectic melting. And it's very relevant to freeze drying because if you have a system like this and you exceed the eutectic melting temperature during the freeze dry process, you've just wrecked the product. It's going to puff and probably spew out solids from the vials. And it's basically going to be a mess, and it's a throw it out and start over. So that is one kind of upper temperature limit to freeze drying is eutectic melting. It does happen. Excipients will form eutectic mixtures. Drugs themselves will form eutectic mixtures with water. And it's why we care so much about characterizing the solution that we're going to freeze dry. Now, it's fair to ask, so when I showed you that videotape, the material that appeared between the ice crystals, you couldn't see ice crystals or sodium chloride crystals there. It's all the same sort of dark consistency. And the reason for that is the crystal size of both the ice that's part of the eutectic mixture and the formulation component that's part of the eutectic mixture, sodium chloride in this case, the crystals are too small to be resolved by an optical microscope. But you can easily see the why you care piece of this, because again, you must not exceed that upper temperature limit or it's a failure point. You ruin the product. So what do we mean? Are you, yes, go ahead.
Silly question probably, but.
No, not at all.
What is the definition of eutectic? If we think in terms of iron carbon diagram, it's minimum temperature to melt something.
Yeah, so what's the definition of a eutectic? For me, a good working definition of a eutectic mixture is that it's an intimate physical mixture of two or more crystalline solids that melts as if it were a single pure compound. And you mentioned, certainly, eutectic formation in metallurgy is very important. I think eutectic comes from the Greek term meaning low melting. And if you look at a phase diagram of sodium chloride and water, the eutectic mixture is the lowest melting component of that system. So, yeah, low melting, but again, yes.
Steve, I have a question. I want to thank you for the visual because until I saw the dendritic ice, I don't think I ever really quite had it in my head that when we have this frozen material, it's a phase separated material.
Right.
That we have an ice phase and we have, in this case, an eutectic phase.
Right.
Quite distinct. And of course, by the time we get a product, we don't want a phase separated amorphous solid that contains, I don't want a phase separated amorphous solid that contains protein. And so I'm imagining and don't know that it's not always necessarily the case that what you have here as a eutectic phase is itself a single phase. So is there the possibility of phase separation in what is here, the eutectic, that later leads to problems in product quality? Is that a thing, or we're not off track?
No, you're not off track. I'm trying to follow what you were saying, and you had mentioned about a eutectic being a single phase, but actually it's not a phase, it's a mixture, because you've got two phases that are intimately mixed. Even looking at it under a microscope, it looks like a single phase, but if you could look at it under higher magnification, you can see that it's a mixture of two phases, ice and, in this case, sodium chloride.
So I guess what I'm getting at is what I'm looking at, is there a way, what is the origin of phase separation, in a final product, not during freezing or primary drying or secondary drying, but by the time that we get to the final product, we sometimes generate phase separated product that has mannitol crystallizing out of
exactly
that contains protein, and we want that, or we have crystallization that wasn't desirable. Is the origin of that, does it go all the way back to the freezing step?
I think it does. I think it does because you've got all kinds of phase separation. When ice crystals first form, that's a phase separation. When you get eutectic crystallization, that's another phase separation. In some formulations that have mixtures of polymeric materials, you can get a phase separation that's rich in one and depleted in the other, and vice versa. That's a phase separation. So I think you got phase separations all over the place.
And happening as early as freezing.
Yes, happening as early as freezing. Yeah, I think that's an appropriate way to look at it. Okay. So I think this next, yeah, this is actually written out definition of what constitutes a eutectic mixture. And why we care, it represents a failure point. Some examples of eutectic melting temperatures, glycine, mannitol, polyethylene glycol, poloxamer will do that, kind of to my surprise. We don't really care about calcium chloride ice. That's an unusually low eutectic melting temperature. Just some notes. Some people think that if you have sodium chloride present in a formulation, it will form a eutectic mixture. That's not necessarily true. The video I showed you was just sodium chloride and nothing else, nothing to get in the way of sodium chloride crystallization. But if you have other formulation components there, they do get in the way. And so just because you have sodium chloride there doesn't mean that the sodium chloride phase separates to form a eutectic mixture. It may remain dispersed in an amorphous material. So that's a pretty common misperception that needs to be pointed out. The relative concentration of sodium chloride in the formulation, okay, that where I said other formulation components tend to get in the way, and the effective freezing rate. Fast freezing may not allow enough a time for the sodium chloride to crystallize. That's possible. It can get stuck in the amorphous state because maybe the system gets too viscous too fast. So both of those determine whether you'll actually get the phase separation to form a eutectic mixture. So let me go back. I'm going to go back to that diagram here. So we looked at this leg where we get solute crystallization. Buffer precipitation. It turns out that the most common excipient in injectable formulations is sodium phosphate, a dibasic monobasic buffer system. The dibasic salt of sodium phosphate tends to crystallize and precipitate And if you remember from freshman chemistry, there's something called Le Chatelier's principle. When you have a system at equilibrium, the equilibrium shifts and tries to make up for the lost material that's precipitating, and you get as a result of that a pH shift upon freezing. We'll have more to say about it later, but use of a buffer can be paradoxical. The presence of a buffer can cause much bigger pH changes upon freezing than if you had just left the buffer out. So, it could be that, again, we're dealing with a single component system. Let's say now instead of sodium chloride, we have mannitol dissolved in water. Well, all this is still the same, but mannitol tends to form a glassy state. Do you understand what I mean by a glassy system? An amorphous system, basically that you have a random arrangement of atoms and molecules with no crystal lattice, no long-range order present. It'll form that initially, but then it doesn't take much thermal energy. We call this annealing. We'll encounter this term during the course, and I'll define what I mean by it now. It's where you take the shelf temperature down to minus 45 or minus 50, hold it for a while, and then you warm the system up. Let's say to minus 20. Not enough to melt the ice, but to try to provide enough thermal energy to get some component or components of the formulation to crystallize. Okay? So during an annealing process, you would get crystallization of the mannitol. So this is possible. Again, mannitol is the best example. This leg, things just stay amorphous. Nothing, it becomes, the freeze concentrate becomes more concentrated and more viscous until it finally goes through a glass transition. And let me pause now. Do you know what I mean by a glass transition? Anybody? Don't be shy. Basically, it's a temperature region where the viscosity may change by several orders of magnitude. Okay. I have a story from my younger years when I had a motorcycle, and I had this brand new motorcycle, and I was so proud of it, and I was out running errands on a Saturday afternoon, a hot day, it was probably in the high 80s, low 90s, and I stopped at a store running some errand, and I parked my cycle and put the kickstand down on the asphalt parking lot, and I went in and did my errand, and when I came back, there's the motorcycle laying on its side. So what happened? Nobody knocked it over.
The asphalt.
Yeah. And there's a glass transition associated with that asphalt material. And the warm day and the relative high temperature of the asphalt and the pressure from the kickstand caused the asphalt to flow until the kickstand sunk down and the motorcycle fell over. That's glass transition associated mobility. Chewing gum. If you did a thermal analysis on a piece of chewing gum, you would see a shift in the baseline. More about this later. That corresponds to a glass transition in the chewing gum that would be maybe 17 or 18 degrees. If room temperature is 25, the glass transition of the chewing gum is somewhat below room temperature so that a fresh piece of chewing gum, you can bend it and, you know, it's not going to break. The temperature of the system is above the glass transition of that gum rubber. Okay. In contrast to that, on a cold winter day, and there's a piece of chewing gum that's been left in the car overnight, and the temperature is somewhere below 10 degrees or so, and you try to bend that chewing gum, what's going to happen? It's not going to bend. It's going to break. It's brittle. So that's what happens below the glass transition. Is mechanically rigid, brittle material. When above the glass transition, you get flow. And again, there are other day-to-day examples, but you get the idea of this glass transition. It's particularly important in freeze-drying for two reasons. It often dictates the freezing behavior and therefore the freeze-drying behavior of that formulation is driven by glass transition associated mobility. It's also important in the freeze-dried solid because the glass transition of the solid material can have a big influence on the physical stability of a freeze-dried solid. So it's important twice. So again, glass transitions are a big deal. I'm going to show you another snippet of videotape here that's a real-time look at collapse in freeze-drying. So now we're looking at freeze-drying. We're not looking at freezing. This is the frozen material. This is the dried material. This is the sublimation front. It's gelatin, which has a high, what's called a TG prime. TG prime refers to the glass transition temperature of freeze-concentrated material. It's relatively high, and this gives us the flexibility to carry out freeze drying in real time, rather than trying to get some kind of a time lapse thing going on. And you can actually see the sublimation front moving from left to right across your field of view. This is the microstructure of the dried solid. Again, the frozen system, and we're making systematic changes in the temperature. We're actually warming this up now. The TG prime of this system is about minus 10 degrees C. So we're seeing how the microstructure of the dried solid changes as a function of sample temperature in light of that glass transition temperature. You can see now that we're above the TG prime temperature, and you start to see changes in the microstructure of the dried layer. Note that we're not seeing changes back here. This material is frozen. Collapse is an attribute of the partially dried material. What it means is that when you sublime away the ice crystals and you're above the TG prime temperature, the system isn't rigid enough to support its own weight. It flows under the force of gravity. You lose the microstructure, and that's what we call collapse. And now you can see collapse developing pretty obviously here. Collapse is always accompanied by a decrease in the specific surface area of solids because of flow just under the force of gravity. And we're fussing with the sample temperature and just seeing what influence that has, again, on the microstructure of the dried solids. You can see now that we've established a band of collapsed material where this remembers what the sample temperature was at that time. And we're continuing the process. Now we're below TG prime, and you can see, I hope you can see, that we're starting to reestablish microstructure that we observed back here. So to some extent, this collapse process is reversible, but in a practical sense, once you've collapsed part of the sample, you've kind of wrecked it. Okay? I think you get the idea from that. So, if nothing happens in this freeze-concentrated solute, doesn't like to crystallize from a freezing system, the freeze-drying behavior is determined by viscoelastic properties of that freeze concentrate. It's characterized by a glass transition temperature of the freeze concentrate, and you might want to, if you've got notes, you might want to make a notation, because I forgot to do it, that's called TG with a little prime at the side of it, to distinguish it from TG, which would refer to the glass transition temperature of the amorphous freeze-dried solid. Oh, there it is. Okay. It's the basis for what we call collapse in freeze-drying. Generally ruins the pharmaceutical acceptability of the product unless it's what we call micro-collapse, and we'll get to that later. Anamorphous freeze-dried solids have a glass transition temperature as well. It's important in determining the physical stability of the product. More about this a bit later. Just as an example, freeze-dried sucrose at a residual moisture level of maybe 0.5% would have a TG of about 65 degrees, but you don't have to add much water to that before you bring that glass transition temperature down pretty dramatically. It's why it's important to characterize our freeze-dried solid, you know, and determine that if you can detect a TG temperature there, what is it and how is it influenced by varying the level of residual moisture. That should be incorporated into the development exercise. You've seen this slide or one like it before. I think this is stuff we've already covered. This is just meant to illustrate that there are various degrees of collapse. From this would be total collapse, no question that you just throw that away. Partial collapse, probably throw that away too. Again, comments about why it matters. We have two extremes. If we take our sodium chloride example and contrast that to our, let's say it's a sucrose example. We know sucrose doesn't like to crystallize from a freezing system. In this case, almost all of the water is frozen. It's either present as pre-eutectic ice or ice that's part of a eutectic mixture. Okay. The practical significance of that is in a system like this, where you have little, if any, unfrozen water, you have little, if any, secondary drying. In other words, when primary drying is done, you're essentially done with the process. Sucrose, on the other hand, it will only freeze concentrate about so much. It will freeze concentrate till it gets to be about 80% sucrose. That means there's still 20% unfrozen water in this interstitial material. That's quite a bit of water to remove during secondary drying. And it's why for some formulations, secondary drying can take a long time. So differences in, very big difference in terms of the need for secondary drying in this case versus this case. Also, because eutectic melting temperatures, there are some exceptions, but most eutectic melting temperatures for organic compounds frozen from an aqueous system are relatively high. They'll be in the range of minus a degree. The eutectic melting temperature of mannitol is only about minus one. Glycine is about minus 3.5, minus 4. Quite a few compounds that are in the minus 10 to minus 12, minus 13 range, something like that. What does it mean? It means you can be pretty aggressive with the drying conditions relative to other formulations that have very low glass transition temperatures. In this case, with sodium chloride, it has a TG prime temperature of around minus 33, minus 34. So there are big differences in the upper product temperature limit during primary drying between a system that's crystalline and a system that's amorphous. Now, we've been keeping this simple, and we've been using as examples systems where there's just one solute. But of course, in real formulations, you've got a mixture. Which do you get? If you have a system consisting of sodium chloride and sucrose dissolved in water, and you freeze that, what do you get? Well, you're going to get some combination, depending on relative concentrations of sucrose or sodium chloride. So you can get a mixed kind of behavior. In that case, you base the failure point on the lowest temperature. You might observe both a glass transition temperature, a TG prime, and eutectic melting. But in that case, you base cycle development, the failure point, on whatever the lowest temperature is. It's usually going to be a TG prime, which again is predictive of collapse. Okay. And then I've also mentioned that there can be night and day differences in the solid state stability of a drug product depending on whether it is, whether it crystallizes during freezing or whether it remains amorphous. And in some cases, when it doesn't like to crystallize, that can rule out freeze drying as a unit operation. Oh, this is just some examples of cephalosporins tend to do this. We're comparing solid state stabilities between the crystalline and amorphous forms of these three different cephalosporins. This is admittedly extreme. 3 months at 50 degrees. We do some stress stability testing for formulation screening at 50 degrees. But this is, there again, it's at the upper end of aggressive stress stability testing. But if we look at cefamandol naphthate, in its crystalline form, less than 1% after this amount of time at this temperature, as compared with 15% in the amorphous state. And again, less than 1 versus 30%, 6 versus 36%. But again, you can have night and day differences in solid state stability depending on the physical state of the drug. So, characterization of a formulation we want to freeze dry is an important part of the whole development exercise. We, in our lab, we use thermal analysis and freeze dry microscopy. There are other methods like some people like to monitor the electrical resistance or the impedance of a frozen system as a function of temperature. We tend to stay away from that because of the lack of standardized equipment. You know, when you buy a thermal analyzer, you can use, there are different manufacturers of thermal analyzers, but they all work pretty much the same way. Whereas electrical thermal analysis, the equipment is much more homemade and the results you get are much more subjective and, in my opinion, really hard to interpret. So we stick to these as sort of tried and true methods. Are you familiar with thermal analysis pretty much? Yeah, it's based on the idea that a physical or chemical change in a material with a change in temperature is always accompanied by either absorption or release of energy in the form of heat. And a thermal analysis instrument is just a way of quantitating that, determining the temperatures at which these transitions occur, whether they're endothermic or exothermic. And experimentally, it's simple. This is just a micropipette with maybe 10 microliters of our formulation. This little aluminum cup is where the sample goes. There's a lid that goes on top of that, and then you seal that lid in place. And you put it, this is a TA Instruments thermal analyzer. You put your little sample cup in the sample compartment. This is the sample. This is a thermally inert reference. It's just an empty pan and lid. You want something as a reference material that doesn't undergo any changes over the temperature range of interest, which in our case is going to be somewhere around between about minus 50 degrees and just above freezing. And it's pretty simple. It's simple experimentally, and in principle, it's pretty simple in terms of interpreting the results. You only have three things that can happen. One is melting. This is an example, a thermogram of eutectic of a frozen system that undergoes eutectic melting. It's not sodium chloride. I don't remember what it is, but basically, this endotherm corresponds to melting of the eutectic mixture. This corresponds to melting of the ice that formed during the freezing process. Of course, we always focus on the lowest temperature event, and this says to us that our upper product temperature limit during primary drying ought to be somewhere around minus 24 or minus 25 degrees. Otherwise, we risk eutectic melting ruining the product. This is a glass transition temperature. It's a shift in the baseline toward higher heat capacity. Okay? As I said before, if I ran a DSC on chewing gum, this would probably be in the range of 16 to 18 degrees or so. In this case, it's for sucrose, and again, you can see it's about minus 33 degrees. It's important because it's the basis, the physical chemical basis for collapse. This exotherm says that some component of the formulation crystallized during the freezing process. This happens to be of a mannitol-containing system, and you always get this as a kind of a signature in the thermogram of mannitol, where there's a low-temperature glass transition, there's an endotherm that nobody understands very well, but it's always there. And then you get, boom, this is release of heat associated with the crystallization of mannitol. So I said before there, easy enough in principle. In practice, there are always things that gum up the works. For example, I said that a lot of organic compounds that like to crystallize from a freezing system have high eutectic melting temperatures, and you may have a resolution problem. In other words, the ability of the instrument to distinguish between two thermal events that happen at very nearly the same temperature, so that you could, for mannitol, I've never been able to recognize eutectic melting of mannitol. It's just too close to the melting endotherm of ice, and basically you see one thermal event that's actually two. So resolution can be an issue. In the case of the glass transition, sometimes you just don't see this. Maybe because the heat capacity change at the glass transition is too small for the instrumentation to pick it up. Maybe because of interaction between formulation components, this kind of gets lost, and such that it's not a distinct, you know, approaching a step change in the heat capacity of the sample. There's also, as a more subtle point, in the protein, or in there's in the viscoelastic properties of materials world, there are things that are called strong glasses and fragile glasses. I don't know if you're familiar with the literature. A strong glass tends to have a very wide glass transition region and a minimal change in heat capacity at that glass transition. So it may be there and you just can't see it. Fragile glasses, on the other hand, that sucrose is an example, that you get a pretty abrupt change over a narrow range, and it's pretty easy to see. So just because you run thermal analysis system doesn't mean you're going to get something that's this easy to recognize. This is our sodium chloride example. No big surprise here. Two thermal events, eutectic melting of the ice sodium chloride eutectic and melting of the ice that first formed during freezing. Very easy to interpret. This is a freeze-dry microscope system. Now, I'm going to be quick in my coverage of this because Rube, it's going to be the subject for after lunch. He has a very nice presentation on this and a very nice demonstration of freeze-dry microscopy, but I'll just tell you for now that this is basically a freeze-drying stage that sits on the stage of a polarizing light microscope. It's basically a little freeze dryer. You can control the temperature, you know, down to, you know, has a Dewar of liquid nitrogen. You can go down to minus 150 if you want to. We seldom do. You can control the pressure in the system. The red thing is a pressure gauge, and there's a pressure control mechanism so that you can put a little drop of your sample on a cover slip to a microscope, put it on the stage, freeze it, dry it, and actually watch it, watch what's happening to it in real time. A couple of experimental details. Again, Ruben's going to have a lot more to say about this. We never use regular microscope slides because they're too thick. We use cover slips only. Have to be aware of temperature gradients. It's important to check temperature measurement accuracy, both at atmospheric pressure and under vacuum. We want some kind of a coupling fluid between the bottom cover slip and the actual the surface that the sample sits on, because we carry out these observations under a relatively high vacuum, and it may look like the cover slip is in intimate thermal contact with the stage of this little freeze dryer, but it really helps to have silicone oil there as a coupling fluid. And this is just a few examples where we can tell look at the microstructure of the dried solid. This material is frozen. Here's the sublimation front. This is just a snapshot. Notice how the microstructure that was established by freezing is retained in the dried material. That's what we want. This, basically experimentally, we freeze the sample, we pull a vacuum on it, we wait till the sublimation front gets in our field of view, and then we make systematic changes in the temperature of the sample and see the result, the impact on the microstructure of the resulting freeze-dried solid. So in this case, we've been below the collapse temperature, and we've made periodic increases in temperature until we see this. Again, I like pictures because nobody's going to argue that that material has collapsed. At this point, we have decreased the temperature again, and we've reestablished the kind of freeze-drying with retention behavior that we want. We can examine morphology of ice crystals. See the feathers here? We've got a blue feather and a yellow feather. That's, again, dendritic ice crystals. The colors are somewhat artificial. We're using a cross-polar and what's called a first-order red compensator. More about this from Ruben later. But it's still useful to look at the morphology of the ice. This example is, I don't even remember what the formulation is. It doesn't matter. But I used the sort of the normal formulation concentration, and then we made it a lot more concentrated, I think up to maybe 10 times more concentrated. And when we froze it, we got material that looked like this, very different morphology of the ice. This ice, I think you'd agree, is dendritic ice, that feathery appearance. But at a much higher concentration, it doesn't look that way at all. The term for this is spherulite. It's where you have ice crystals that are thin fibers of ice that go radially outward from the point where the ice nucleated. And it's important because the thinness of these fibers of ice. And as you sublime away the ice, you're creating really tiny pores in the dried material, and the result of that is a very, very long freeze-dry process. The reason I mention it is that many people think, well, I want to keep the concentration of my formulation as high as I can because I've got less water to remove. And yes, that makes sense. But you have to be aware of the potential influence of formulation concentration on the morphology of the ice, because this is self-defeating. Yes, you've used a higher concentration, but you've created a structure of ice that is going to cause freeze-drying to take forever. So it's just something to be aware of. And again, this is just a little bit of a case study of a freeze-dried product. Some drug in mannitol, and they actually use an acetate buffer in this, which isn't an acetate buffer in freeze-drying is not a very good idea because the acetate tends to disappear during the freeze-dry process. But at any rate, they didn't ask us. So here's the frozen material. This is freeze-drying at, this is minus 33 degrees. This is actually meant to illustrate the influence of annealing, or the potential influence of annealing, on freeze-drying behavior. Remember we talked about annealing? Freeze it, warm it up, not enough to melt the ice, hold it for a while, and then you either cool it back down or you start primary drying directly from the annealing temperature. Either one is acceptable. But what I want to call your attention to is the holes in the dried material. Again, this is frozen. This is the sublimation front. It's a snapshot as the sublimation front is moving from the bottom to the top of your field of view. We call this partial collapse. And you can see why, that we've got regions of voids that resulted from collapsed material. And as we increase the time and maybe increase the temperature, we've increased the temperature to minus 30. Again, we're getting more visible gaps in material. Good example of what we call partial collapse. Another example, we're at minus 27. Situation's getting worse. And it kind of brings up the point of sources of uncertainty in freeze-dry microscopy. What we want to know is what product temperature corresponds to ruining the material as we would determine by visual examination of the freeze-dried solid. We don't really know. We know this is partially collapsed. Some people would call this micro-collapse. But we also see that there's still a network of solid material that seems to be holding the whole thing together. Okay? We really don't know. We know that this situation gets worse with increased time and with increased temperature here at minus 25, but you know, we're still getting a largely interconnected network of solids. So again, the point I'm trying to make is it's not always clear whether a collapsed temperature that you would observe by looking under a microscope would correspond to collapse that you could actually see in a vial of freeze-dried drug product. Now, we've done the same thing, except we've annealed this material. Same formulation, same freezing temperature. We've just warmed it up to, I think, minus 15 degrees for a while. It doesn't really matter. But again, this is the frozen material. This is the freeze-dried solid. You can see that's a uniform texture. It's a uniform color. And we're here at minus 24. We're well above the collapse temperature that we would have observed on the unannealed material. And now we're at minus 15. No change. Now we're at minus 12. No change. Now we're getting some change. We're all the way up to minus 7 degrees, and we're starting to see some collapse taking place. But the point I'm trying to make is that you've really dramatically improved the freeze-drying behavior and the process efficiency by doing this annealing step. It's probably an underutilized practice in the industry, but it can be very useful. Okay, so we've been talking about freezing as a stochastic or a random process. We know eventually every vial is going to freeze, but we don't know for any given vial when it's, you know, how much supercooling it's going to undergo and when it's going to actually get ice nucleation. And there's a lot of interest in the industry in getting better control of this process. And it's developing technology, and industry has not yet embraced any one, but there are basically three of them. There's rapid depressurization, that I'll call the Prax-Air method. What that is that normally when we freeze vials that we're going to freeze dry, it takes place at atmospheric pressure. We don't pull a vacuum until the freezing process is over. In the case of rapid depressurization, we cool the material and freeze it at elevated pressure, maybe 28, 30 psi. And then when the sample temperature gets to the point where we want to nucleate it, we open a valve and we very rapidly drop the pressure in the system to atmospheric. And if you haven't seen this video, I'll show you, because it's kind of impressive. This is stochastic, but I think this is all part of the same video clip. You've already seen this, but it doesn't last very long. Okay, here's controlled nucleation. Boom. Notice two things. Every vial seemed to freeze at the same time, and every vial froze, at least the nucleation, went from the top down. Okay. So it's something that really makes a lot of sense in terms of process consistency, process efficiency. You can get controlled freezing at the lowest practical level of supercooling. So why hasn't the whole industry embraced this technology? Well, I think they will eventually, but there are competing methodologies out there, and I think, you know, the pharmaceutical world is awfully conservative. It's really frustrating sometimes. They just do not really embrace change. So that's the rapid depressurization method. One of the things that we are a little bit concerned about is that rapid depressurization process. One, it's very loud. We've got a flashing light on our control LIO, and you get this little siren before it depressurizes, because there's some noise associated with that. But another concern that's been voiced that's probably fair is, what's the long-term impact of this mechanical jolt you're applying to this very expensive system in terms of wear and tear? We're talking about maybe leaks in the shelf, maybe leaks in the tubing that carries heat transfer fluid to and from the shelf. Nobody really knows what this repeated rapid depressurization, what effect that's going to have on equipment lifetime. It's a fair concern, because, again, we're talking about millions of dollars for a production scale freeze dryer. You have to be careful that you don't abuse it. A competing technology is an ice fog, where basically they use liquid nitrogen as a heat exchanger to circulate humidified nitrogen through this heat exchanger, and you basically generate an ice fog that's blown into the freeze dryer. Sometime during the next day or so, I've got another piece of video. I don't want to take the time to look it up right now. I'm not sure where it is. But basically, this ice fog does the same thing. The question there is, in a great big freeze dryer that might have 50,000 vials, are you going to get ice fog in every vial? Well, maybe you will. It's kind of hard to visually verify that. You've got limited line of sight into a freeze dryer. Time will tell. There's another method, the Milrock method, that basically uses the condenser. It's another variation on the ice fog method, where you're just, instead of a liquid nitrogen cooled heat exchanger, they use the condenser itself to generate an ice fog. And that, and again, it seems to work. But as I said, the industry has not yet embraced any of these technologies. We'll just have to wait and see what happens. So that is it as far as the freezing section. Are there any questions or comments or points of disagreement?
For the Canadian step that you do for the super simulation, for the freeze dryer microscopy, in the presentation you just showed the annealing step for the super simulation is raised to collapse temperature and it is 20.
Yeah, it actually wasn't. You're talking about the series of slides for annealed versus unannealed. Yeah, that wasn't sucrose. That was basically the drug and mannitol and a buffer. It was a pretty simple formulation. No. No. Yeah, sucrose would not respond to annealing. Although Jim Searles, a former colleague of mine, he's with Pfizer now. I think Jim's with Pfizer. His PhD research was with Ted Randolph at University of Colorado, and a lot of his thesis was influence of annealing. And even in a system that it doesn't have potentially crystallizing solute, he says that annealing is worthwhile just for the crystal growth of the ice, that you get this phenomenon called Ostwald ripening, where little crystals kind of disappear and bigger crystals get bigger. That you, by annealing it, you get better vial-to-vial consistency in sublimation rate and also overall a more efficient process. So just because you don't have something like mannitol or glycine or a drug that you're trying to get to crystallize doesn't mean that annealing's not worthwhile. But I would say that for a solution of sucrose alone, other than an influence on ice crystal growth.
So you have to keep the shift temperature or product temperature as low as possible.
Well, not as low as possible, but below the collapse temperature. Yeah.
I have a question about the interface between the ice phase and the freeze concentrate, or whatever that becomes.
Right.
Do you think that the structure of that interfacial region is different than the bulk of the freeze concentrate when it's frozen? And part of the reason I ask is some of the images that you showed might suggest that that's true, that it's structurally different, or that collapse is an interfacial thing that's happening right at the boundary between the ice and the freeze concentrate. Do you have any comments on that, or is that just an artifact of the way that...
Well, I think it's an interesting question, the whole nature of that ice freeze concentrate interface. It's different because a commonly held view is that that interface consists of going abruptly from a solid system to a fluid system. That's not true. You've got a layer there that's water that doesn't have the same mobility as the liquid water. So it's different in that regard. And I'm sure you already know this, but it's also important in the freeze drying of therapeutic protein world, because there is a It's not a large body of literature, but it's a convincing body of literature that says that one of the mechanisms for loss of protein integrity associated with freeze-drying is the tendency of proteins to adsorb at that interface where they partly unfold. And it's probably driven by the entropy of the system. In other words, you've got this layer of limited mobility water molecules right next to the ice. And the protein, by adsorbing to that surface, frees up a lot of water and increases the overall entropy of the system. I sort of picture that as the driving force for proteins adsorbing at that interface. That process is largely reversible upon freeze thawing, but if you dry it, when you rehydrate that material, the proteins may not refold to their normal configuration, and that can promote aggregation. And it explains a lot of the phenomenology, like freezing rate dependence. Rapid freezing is going to create relatively more of that interface. Influence of surfactants, where you have things like polysorbates that will compete for the protein for occupying that interface and therefore competitively protect the protein. So freezing rate dependence, surfactant. Oh, the other is that, and this is again something that doesn't jump right out at you from the literature, but it's always a good idea, or it's generally a good idea, to use a relatively high concentration of the protein, because the idea is there's only so much of that interface that you can occupy. As you increase the protein concentration, that interface becomes saturated, and any additional protein is protected by being away from that interface. And it's very common to see concentration dependence of recovery of protein activity after freeze drying. So it explains some of that. I think those are the three main sort of phenomenologies that would be explained pretty well by this adsorption at the ice to freeze concentrate interface. Good point. Thank you.